Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
All right, so tonight we are going to talk about, is it better to do something versus nothing? And you had talked to me earlier in the week about this subject of, like a scenario would be, hey, I really thought that changing the oil would do the car better, but I accidentally put in transmission fluid. Hey, look, I didn't know, but it was better to try, right?
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
So before we get started, though, a quick announcement is that we're now on Patreon. If you head yourself over to patreon.com/registrymatters, you can help support the program. Even donating $1 a month would be absolutely amazing. I don't want to push this. We're not doing this for to try and line our pockets. It's a public service. But there are serving costs and hosting costs, and not to mention the time of Larry, and we all appreciate that so very much. And if you happen to be listening to the show via the website, know that you can also download the podcast in your podcast app on iTunes or Google Play and also Stitcher. And Larry, you want to promote a phone call that is happening really short time window from happening tomorrow night.
It is indeed, Andy. We're having NARSL in action, which by the time this is distributed, it'll be the same day. It's going to be Wednesday night, February 7th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can find out how to get connected to us by simply going to narsl.org. And on the homepage, on the right side of the homepage, there's announcements and there's a NARSL in action announcement that will connect you. I could give out the phone number and the code, but that would take some time. But if those of you who don't want to go through that trouble, it is area code 641-715-3660. And the access code is 957-605 pound. And if you call in at 7 Eastern Time, we're going to be on for 3 hours talking about a sensational decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court declaring their most recent enhanced version of registration to be punishment and thus violates the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and the state of Pennsylvania Constitution's ex post facto clause. So it'd be a great program. We're going to have a lot of people interested in that, and there's quite a large number of people signed up.
Excellent. That's going to be awesome. And as we've started doing lately, we have some news items to cover. So this one comes from the Des Moines Register, where a man who pled guilty to lascivious acts with a child appears to win a $100,000 lottery prize. And I just bring this up as kind of a happy feel-good kind of thing. So the guy may have done something inappropriate, but he wins a $100,000 lottery prize.
And has the lottery indicated that they're going to gladly pay that prize?
That was the interesting thing, is that they are possibly trying to figure out a way that they won't have to pay the guy since he has pled guilty to these allegations.
So, well, I'm not a big personal fan of lotteries, but that's not really the topic for the response. It's a game of chance, and if the person invested their dollar or $2 or whatever, if they won a scratch or if he won one of the other games, he paid the money and he should be able to collect the prize. But I am aware that the taxpayers out there somehow or another find it objectionable that people win a game of chance, and there has been legislation around the country. I don't know how successful because I haven't tracked it, but I know that there's been bills introduced to deny people the opportunity to win large jackpots because they've done wrong and they shouldn't have that opportunity. So it'd be interesting for us to follow up on that and find out if he was able to collect his prize. $100,000 would probably come in handy for most people on the registry.
Yeah, no kidding. At least he would make store call while he's gone. This comes from the Virginia Pilot. Lawmakers are unfair in targeting sex offenders. A bill in the Senate will require registrants to self-disclose if they go to an evacuation center. It will be a felony if they don't. However, no notification will be sent to the individuals affected by the change. A similar bill senators closely scrutinized didn't include a notification element for those affected. Mary Davie DeVoy said, "Is this inconsistency? Is it cherry picking? Is it hypocrisy? Whatever you want to call it's 100% intentional and dishonorable." So what this article is talking about is just showing about the hypocrisy that the senators are scrutinizing a bill that would affect people affected by a firearms change of policy. And they want to make sure that they get notified prior to, that way nobody is just caught red-handed, or not red-handed, caught dumbfounded going against this new policy. But at the same time, having a policy change for sex offenders, they are almost purposely setting them up for failure for them to put that bill through.
So, well, I'm not surprised that the firearms industry has a huge lobby, multi-millions across the country. And anytime there's anything that's going to affect firearm ownership in every legislative body around the country, there are people from the NRA and other advocates of the firearm industry present. So a bill that would change anything related to firearms would get very close scrutiny and a lot of questions, because the lawmakers would be provided those questions in advance by the lobbyists that represent the firearms industry. When it comes to people on the registry, there's not really a lot of advocates around the country that are able to be in the Capitol and be able to provide the constant support for our side. So bills don't tend to get as much scrutiny. The people that are there speaking on behalf of the bills are usually the law enforcement apparatus, as I've described it, and that would be the prosecutors, the police agencies, the criminal justice side of it, and we're usually absent. And in fact, there are people who don't believe that the sex offenders should even be at the table and they shouldn't even be heard, because they've done something really bad and they shouldn't even be paid any attention to. So I'm not surprised that the firearm would have gotten a lot more scrutiny.
But just to be clear, that what one person, what there are so many classifications of what would be considered a sexual offense. It's not always having indecent liberties with a 3-year-old. It could be something with an adult that it was more of a professional relationship, but it was under like medical conditions where you're maybe like a treatment provider, and now you're listed as a sex offender, even though you had a relationship, almost, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, they were both adults. And that wouldn't be construed as something inappropriate, but because of his position, you could have a law in place that would make that a sex crime.
You very well could, and we do in many instances where there's any type of authoritarian relationship working in correctional facilities. I think that in many states, the law prohibits consensual relations, and it would criminalize that. So yes, I would agree, but the firearm industry carries an awful lot of ammunition, and there's no pun intended, but they have a lot of resources that they bring to bear, and everything that's going to impact the ownership and possession of firearms or ammunition gets a lot of scrutiny in legislatures across the country.
And that this article comes from the New York Post. Oklahoma considers chemical castration for sex offenders. A Republican lawmaker is pushing to add Oklahoma to the list of states in which so-called chemical castration is an option for certain sex offenders, albeit an option that rarely gets used. If approved, Oklahoma would join at least 7 other states that have laws allowing courts to order chemical treatments to reduce male testosterone for certain sex offenders. Although experts say the punishment is rarely carried out, and one described it as half-fantasy version of criminal justice. When I knocked on that guy's door when I was campaigning, he said, "I'll vote for you if you run this bill." So, I guess chemical castration is a thing, but this isn't that. This is almost like putting saltpeter in eggs to keep desires down.
That's the way I interpret that. I think it's kind of funny that the New Yorker would say a Republican lawmaker, because in Oklahoma, I'm not sure there's anything other than Republican lawmakers in that very conservative red state, but perhaps there is a Democrat somewhere in the state assembly. It is a little misleading, because castration would actually be the removal of the organs, and I don't think that we could compare a medication, a drug that would suppress the sexual urges with castration. So it's I believe they call that a euphemism. That sounds good, but in terms of the options, now here's where I answer with a question. If a person has truly, if they're acting out is because of urges that are difficult for them to suppress themselves, And they're faced with a choice of serving time behind bars, which will at least curtail those appetites that keep them behind the prison walls, or being ordered to go undergo a treatment with suppressive drugs. And it's a choice that they're allowed to make. Would that be so bad?
Yeah, I guess given the two choices, I guess you would pick the treatment over going to prison. So is there actually such a thing that would you could take some sort of medicine or a sequence of medicines that would neuter you?
I remember seeing, I think the drug was called Depo-Provera, and that was a drug many years ago that I heard of that was supposed to do that. And so if there is such a drug, and if it was an option, we're all about options, right? We wouldn't want to incarcerate a person if there was an option that could help them with those urges.
Seems kind of sketchy to me, frankly. Moving on, this one is from Sosin.org. 4 years after being called out on poor public policy, Florida is still putting children at risk. Why are there so many children and families of former offenders being placed in danger from missed opportunities of effective legislation? Are the children of citizens on the sex offender registry less valuable to lawmakers? Nearly 4 full years later, we are still waiting a satisfactory answer. As of May 24th, 2017, there were almost 70,000 people listed on the Florida State Sex Offender Registry, and the number grows daily. Legislators have neglected to accept the fact that registered citizens have families and children who are also affected by these restrictive laws and become victims of vigilante crimes, harassment, community ostracism, and detrimental restrictions placed on them. So yeah, I mean, this isn't, there's so much collateral damage, and this isn't just related to sex offenders, but once you get put on having a felony and you try and go get a job, now you're reduced in the number of jobs you can get, which then restricts your housing. Obviously, it's magnified for people on the registry. But is there any thought when the legislators are looking at these bills to consider the collateral damage?
Well, I want to give a shout out to our NARSL affiliate in Florida, the Florida Action Committee, which they are doing with very limited resources. They're doing a very good job of trying to carry that message to Tallahassee. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of thought given because this, as I say frequently, when these bills are considered in most of our assemblies around the country, they're part-time assemblies with people who work regular jobs, and they have very limited resources in terms of staff to do research. So they get their background information from people who show up and tell them the unintended consequences. So it's very difficult to encourage registrants to band together and go to the Capitol, be it Tallahassee or be it wherever, Lincoln, Nebraska. It's difficult to get them to go tell these stories. And the stories are very compelling when I've seen them told, because the lawmakers really do roll their eyes and say they hadn't considered that because they'd never been told. So it's a matter of the community of offenders being willing to come out and tell these stories and tell them publicly. You'll see a different emotional reaction when the story is told, when they know that the person was kicked off the cheerleading squad because of something that was beyond their control, and they're ridiculed. Or that you can go on and on. We could spend this entire program talking about the collateral damage. But believe it or not, most lawmakers are unaware of it. All they're hearing from is the advocates, the public safety people telling them how much that they appreciate. In my state, every single time there's a bill to change anything about the registry, they come in and they tell statistically how many people have sent them emails or phone calls telling them how much they appreciate the website and how helpful it is to them to keep their family safe. And that is never countered by any testimony from our side saying how people have been harmed by the registry. So the lawmakers truly don't know. They only get a one-dimensional view, which is from the proponents of, which would be the victims' advocacy and the law enforcement apparatus.
I hinted about this last week of trying to walk you down answering all the questions about being an advocate and how much a vote matters, or being an advocate and going and speaking to the legislators and how much that matters. So what you are then saying again is for us to have any sort of impact in improving our situation, we have to lock arms, band together, do it individually, donate money, hire lawyers to get in front of these politicians so that it's not just a one-sided story.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're doing with the resources we have. And where we do that, we have lots of successes. Lots of bad legislation is stopped in the states where we have strong affiliates, not all, but simply from hearing, Maryland would be an example where many bills have been killed. My state, many bills have been killed. Texas bills have been killed. Florida bills have been impacted by the advocacy there. But oftentimes it's a one-person operation. It's one retired person who receives no salary, difficult to even cover their cost of going to their capital. If they don't happen to live in their capital city, then they have lodging costs. If they need to be at a 9 o'clock hearing that's scheduled for 9 a.m. and they live 200 miles away, that's not really practical to get there. And we have states across the country where there are great distances to travel. Every state's not the size of Delaware or New Hampshire.
Right. So from Handbasket Notes at blogspot.com, Iowa legislator wants to move the goalposts. This bill addresses the problem of sex offenders that time out of the registry after a set number of years, usually 10, and then move to a new area of the state or move into Iowa from another state. If a sex offender has timed out, law enforcement has no way of knowing this person is in their community. This bill establishes a new requirement for any person that has ever had to register as a sex offender in Iowa or in any other jurisdiction to register with the county sheriff when they move into or around the state. This classification of sex offenders would not be required to re-register quarterly or annually like other classes of sex offenders. All right, I think this is kind of related to the Pennsylvania decision that's going to be talked about tomorrow night, that you can't change things after your sentence has been passed down to you.
Well, we will be talking about that, and that's not exactly what the decision says. The decision says you cannot do anything that adds punishment. So the question would be, in this instance, would be whether this requirement to simply register in a non-public setting would be additional punishment. And I've read the legislation, and I'm firmly against it. The organization that I serve on the board of is firmly against it. Is that resource issue that we talked about earlier. We don't have any resources in Iowa. We can't put anybody in the Capitol to get our side out about how this is in fact moving the goalpost. So what is actually likely to play out will be that since there's no opposition and the law enforcement apparatus will be telling them, hey, yeah, this would be a great thing because otherwise we lose track of these people without any opposition. They're likely to endorse this because they'll say it's a relatively benign requirement. But the problem with the benign requirement is that once there's a new database established that's not public, the victims' advocates will howl bloody murder. And the community advocates will howl bloody murder that there's a database and our law enforcement will not turn it over to us because by statute it's private. So all of a sudden the advocates will descend on the Capitol of Iowa and they'll say, what do you mean keeping this information private? How can we protect our families? And it'll be little of no time within a couple of years to where this supposedly private registry will magically become public. And then they'll say, well, gee, these people move around and they don't notify us timely because they're allowed 30 days under this new proposal, which in most instances registers require a much shorter duration. They're going to say, God only knows what could happen in a 30-day period of time. They should have to update within 3 days. So all of a sudden, they're going to begin to stack new requirements on this. And this new registry that started out relatively benign, like the first registration schemes did, will quickly transform to being punitive. But we're in a situation where we don't know what we can do about it because we don't have thousands of dollars to put a lobbyist in the Capitol in Iowa to say, stop, boys and girls.
Right. Is this, maybe you don't know the answer, would a private database like that be subject to a FOIA request?
That's exactly what would happen. It's okay. Happened in states in Arkansas, where the level ones and twos public, people have demanded it, and they've cited that it goes contrary to public records because they're registering with a public entity. It happened in Washington State, where the state Supreme Court ended up siding with the people demanding access to it. So even though they don't put the level ones and twos on the internet, you can go in and get the information. Well, what do you suppose our great capitalist system does once someone acquires that list through a FOIA request or whatever they refer to it in that state? What do you suppose they do to it with it?
They're going to charge people to gain access to it.
It becomes absolutely, and then all of a sudden, what was private is now public.
And once it's on the internet, it never goes away.
So it's it seldom ever goes away. I'm not an internet expert, but I know I find stuff that's 30 plus years old that hasn't gone away. So,
you know, and also I was listening to a completely unrelated podcast, and I'm going to try and dig this out of my memory, but I wanted to talk about it. And the two hosts were talking about the advocacy work they do in a different subject, but that one of the hosts applied for a job and was denied, and it was because of their social media presence that they didn't agree with what she was doing. And so in a different context, what you do on the internet, whether you do it voluntarily or not voluntarily, can impact you and have permanent ramifications of whether you can be successful or not. So if this person experiences it through a voluntary type of social media presence, what happens when it's an involuntary thing? And obviously there's this huge stigma associated with being on the registry.
Well, the body of case law is going to begin to grow on that. That was in the Pennsylvania Muniz decision where the court recognized the damage happening from the internet. I think there are better days ahead in terms of the fertility of this litigation about the harm from these databases and the negative.
Yeah, I don't see how they're able to argue against it anymore. There's just, with 3 billion people alone on Facebook, there's no way that anybody can make an argument that says that it's not punitive to have your information publicly available on the internet with that many people accessing your information at will.
So, well, of course, the advocates for it would say you should have thought about that before you did what you did.
Right, but
you couldn't have thought about it. People are subject to these disclosures 30, 40 years for offenses that they did 30, 40 years ago.
But should you be subjected to vigilantism after the fact?
Well, absolutely not. But I think the bigger question is, should you be subject to perpetual punishment? We in this country have long since believed, at least that's what we've claim we believe, that once a punishment has been imposed and served, that it's ended and the person has been redeemed. Whether or not they've been redeemed internally, that's a matter for them to decide if they're going to continue to engage in criminality. But for us to continue to shame that person after they've paid their debt, that goes against everything I thought America stood for. And that's what we do. We never let them live down a mistake, regardless of how many years after they've paid their debt to society. And we're going to have to come to grips with that because a significant number of people in this country have felony convictions. And they're carrying the stigma of that felony conviction with them, and it impairs their ability to support themselves. And I say this, and I'll say it again tonight. It's in our interest, particularly the people my age and older, to have people earning as much money as they possibly can earn so they can support the systems that we like to draw from. Whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, those people need to be the taxpayers, not tax consumers. So it's in our interest to let people pass, go behind them and be forgotten so they can be productive taxpaying citizens. It's kind of short-sighted on our part to act as if we are not harmed by what we're doing to them, because we are harmed by millions of disenfranchised people who cannot fully participate in our society.
From the Clarion Ledge, sexting bills provide loophole to keep minors from registering as sex offenders. Representative Nick Bain, Democrat Corinth, author of House Bill 1467, said it would allow a minor offender from having to register for the rest of his or her life as a sex offender. Current law makes the crime a felony, requiring registration as a sex offender. Go ahead.
Well, I spotted right away, because I know the city I traveled through, Mississippi, but this is actually a piece of the legislation in Mississippi. And that's another state where I think there's three Democrats still in office. So he must be one of those three. that's still in office. But it's kind of insightful that he appears to be getting a little bipartisan support. The sexting is something that we all did when we were growing up. We didn't send it out on the internet, but I dare say that of all of our listeners out there, somebody flashed their private parts and their junk as they were growing up and going through high school. And the sexting is nothing more than the modern version of the flashing we did and sending it to someone and from the privacy of your own bedroom. So to make that person a sex offender because of something is really disgusting. And thankfully, my state doesn't do that, but it does happen across the country. So I'm glad to see Mississippi, at least one lawmaker in Mississippi has seen that there's a problem with this.
Yeah,
There is.
that one's very troubling. You give a kid a cell phone and now they have a photo, a camera, and they can shoot that stuff all across the globe. And then it can be shared infinitely. So then you have, I remember something a couple of years ago with a kid in, I think it was in North Carolina. He takes a picture of himself and he's a minor and sends it to his girlfriend. And now he is charged with distributing child porn of himself. So he
And
is
he's a
the
child, and he's
victim.
a child.
Right, and
He's
he's
the
the victim,
victim.
and it's like how does anyone wrap their head around that idea?
So it's
That
absurd. Now, where was that?
I thought that was North Carolina. It's a good
So.
ways back. But I would then make the argument: isn't a person committing suicide and they fail? Isn't that attempted murder?
So, well, the suicide is against the law, certainly assisted suicide, but we learned that with Dr. Jack Kevorkian.
Yes, with Dr. Kevorkian. But I'm just, just to make an extreme example, if you try and commit suicide, do they try you for murder? Fine, it's illegal, but they don't try you for murder. They put you in some sort of a treatment system to get those thoughts out of your head, but they don't try you for murder.
So, well, I would agree with that, but the proponents would argue that the kid has to be punished severely because what they just did has added to the collection of global of this insatiable. There's an insatiable appetite for pictures of underage, and they've just contributed to the trade of all this stuff, and this stuff never goes away. So the kid has to pay a price so that other kids don't do it. That would be their argument.
In
It's a silly
perpetuity.
argument, but a lot of public policy is based upon silly arguments.
Right.
So because there's no one there to counter the silly argument.
Again, back to us getting advocates all over. So this is from what is actually Homeland Security Today, so hstoday.us. Legislation aiming to stop sex trafficking would hurt investigations. The U.S. Senate is actively preparing to vote on Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, SESTA. Advocates in the media portray the legislation as an important step toward preventing sex trafficking, but there's absolutely no empirical evidence to support this notion. In fact, qualitative data and criminological theory suggest that SESTA will result in the displacement and dispersion of commercial sex advertisements, which would inhibit law enforcement efforts to rescue victims and arrest se sex traffickers. So if you brought up this point earlier that if we tell them that we're searching for them, they will probably move. So why would we tell them that that's what's going on, but at the same time let them maintain where they are so you could set up stings very easily to try and shut this kind of activity down?
Well, one would think so, but that's the same argument we make about forcing registrants to listen, that it makes it more difficult to track them. Apparently, there are a lot of people who engage in this promotion of their enterprises that are illegal. They use Backpage and certain sites, and
Craigslist.
Craigslist would be another one. Yeah. And they would, they if they shut those down, those people are not going to magically go out of business. As I say, oftentimes, capitalism is a great system. It tries to get its products out and respond to demand for service. So these there's going to be a demand for these services, so that they're going to disperse these advertisements and they're going to go somewhere. But if I think I've read that more than half of the Senate has signed on as co-sponsors, which means that this probably will move through the U.S. Senate without any difficulty and possibly be presented to the president for a signature. So it's an example of something that feels good, sounds good, but may actually have unintended consequences of diminishing the investigative powers that we have now. I don't know enough about it to say for certain, but it certainly has that potential based on what some are saying.
The key for me here is that there's absolutely no empirical evidence to support this notion. There's a whole lot of policy that goes through that it's just somebody has some sort of knee-jerk reaction to something, and then they go sign off on it, where there's no scientific data, there's no psychological data, there's no any sort of expert testimony to say, hey, we need this thing, but someone makes their community feel good by signing off on it. So then they get reelected over snake oil.
So, well, that is troubling, and it does happen. In this case, it's interesting because if law enforcement is being vocal in their opposition, that would tend to slow down the movement of most legislation. So I'm surprised if law enforcement is expressing reservations that it's got the broad support that it does. But it's not uncommon to have legislation move that simply makes people feel good because it's the system we're in. Yeah. In order to be in office, you have to make people feel good.
And our last article comes from the Crime Report: How Pseudoscience Turns Sex Offenders into Permanent Outlaws. A New York appeals court has rejected the notion that risk prediction under the state Sex Offender Registration Act should have a scientific basis. Let me reread that, though. It says they have rejected the notion that risk prediction under the Sex Offender Registration Act should have a scientific basis. According to the July 2017 decision, People v. Curry, courts must not adhere to a risk assessment instrument that has been repeatedly exposed as pseudoscientific humbug. They may not even consider a scientifically validated instrument such as the Static 99. This looks an awful lot like advanced punishment for a future crime, like the science fiction film Minority Report. It also looks like a second punishment for past offenses, a practice the Constitution frowns on in the Double Jeopardy Clause. Not at all, say the courts. SORA isn't punishment, but merely a regulatory measure to protect public safety. As one legislator puts it, it's like affixing warning labels to toxic substances. I am all about using evidence to figure out the best practice to get us from A to B. And I can't for the life of me, if you have a PhD psychologist, whatever those initials and credentials are, if they say you are not a threat, but here you are with legislators going behind and saying, we're not going to follow that. I just can't wrap my head around why we would do anything that isn't supported by evidence.
So, well, this is an entire program that we could do a podcast on by itself. There's so many questions wrapped up in this that we will only touch on them. But having disclosure, I have not read People versus Curry, so I can't really comment on the July 2017 decision. But what I can comment on is that the courts do not exist to save us from bad public policy. So an appellate court can look at something and say, this may not be an ideal mechanism, but you elected the people who put this on the books. So therefore, if you've got a problem with this, then it's not ideal and it doesn't get the result you're looking for. Don't look to us to save you, because the courts can only save you when the Constitution is being trampled. And since the Sex Offender Registration Act in most states has not been proven to be punishment, and particularly in New York, it's actually not that punitive. The people who are rated in those level ones and twos, they only have to report in like every 3 years. And of course, I'm not advocating for registry, so I don't want to get 100 emails saying that you're all of a sudden for the registry. But I'm saying, in terms of trying to demonstrate that it's an extreme hardship and punitive, it's one of the more difficult registries to show that because of the relatively benign requirements that are imposed on the people. So I can see how a court of appeals could say, well, if we were the policymakers, we could come up with a better way to risk assess people, but we're not the policymakers. So therefore, looking at what the policymakers have come up with that you elected, this is not necessarily fantastic, but it's what you chose to do. And for us to substitute our robes and decide that we're going to impose another system that may have huge financial cost, that's not a role for the judiciary to decide. So I can see how that decision could come about, but I'm in agreement with you that if you're going to have a risk assessment system, it ought to be more than junk science. So, and I consider the Static 99 not to be a very good model, because it takes into account what was what it doesn't take into account changes. It's how old you were and how many times you've done something. And you may have done these things 20, 30 years ago, but the static 99 doesn't give much consideration for that. So I don't see that as a validated instrument. So, to answer your question, yes, I can see how they could reach that decision.
Isn't there a more updated static whatever 2003 or something? I thought that it had been updated.
Well, there are a number of since I'm not involved in the front end of criminal defense anymore, I'm not dealing with risk assessments as often as I did years back. But there are a number of risk assessment instruments. They're very costly. Some of them are very costly, and the state of New York has probably decided for its thousands of offenders, however many they have, that they don't want to expend something that's going to be very costly. It's much easier to sit down and check box. It's far less costly. And that's what the state has decided to have. Now, the people who get a level that requires them to register frequently and for life and to be disclosed to the public, that those people in New York probably don't think it's a very good system at all. The people who are shielded from public disclosure probably think the system's pretty good, because if they lived in Florida, or if they lived in Alabama, or if they lived in Louisiana, or I could go on and on with states, regardless of their level of threat, they would be on the internet. So
Right.
it is a better system for the people who are not being humiliated by public disclosure. I would guess that Curry was someone who didn't like the assessment that he got, and that would be the basis for the challenge. I would assume that he was unhappy. Very few people that were happy would probably initiate a challenge.
Right. But to stick around on this just for a minute, we don't have very good predictors, I don't think, of individuals' behavior. You can't model what 50,000 people have done and pull out that that guy's going to become the serial killer or anything like that. I don't think that those models are, I don't think they're employed. I don't think they're effective.
I agree.
So.
I don't think we have. I don't think we have the ability to predict future behavior with any degree of certainty.
Which is why they bring up the Minority Report analogy in this article. It's just troubling. It bugs me. So we had a couple comments from episode 9, who represents the victim. John suggested that if you don't like it, then you should just leave the country. Sex offenders have no rights. Murderers have more rights. You'd be surprised how much your life is better if you're back to leading a normal life if you leave this country and the police state you live in. Thank you, John, for that. Larry, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I'm disappointed, but I'm not shocked that John would make a comment like that. Usually, a person who will say something like that, they're devoid of any intellectual argument that they can make at that point. So rather than engaging intellectually, they tell you to leave. Well, but they don't even realize how intellectually bankrupt they are, because that's entirely what Donald Trump did when he was running for president. He told us what was wrong with this country. He didn't campaign much on telling us what was right and how great the country was. He said he was going to make America great again. And he pointed out problems. And he said, if you elect me, I would like to fix these problems, which he viewed as problems. Well, that's merely what we're talking about. We love this country. I know I do, and I assume you do, probably as much as John does. And we have every right to try to effectuate change to make the country that we love a better place. So I consider him to be intellectually bankrupt, and that's what I think of his comment. By his logical thinking or illogical thinking, we would never try. We wouldn't have never cured smallpox. We wouldn't have all the advances in technology, because we would just accept things the way they are. In fact, I'd say John's an idiot.
As the First Amendment does say, though, you have the right to the freedom of speech to redress your grievances with the government. So that's what we're doing. It's just that in itself, that's wrapped up in a nutshell what we're trying to do.
And if anybody should leave, I would think that we'd be better off as a country if people that are intellectually bankrupt, like John, would actually leave.
And another comment from Tammy. I want to ask, why can't the sex offender registry have reclassification for offenders with a certain criteria of offenses? There are thousands of people on a violent sex offender registry who were not, or where no violence ever took place, even some where no child was involved with the offender at all. How can a person be classified as a violent offender when there was no violent act and no child was touched by the offender. How did this happen? What kind of system puts this hardship on a person, let alone his or her family? Lifetime restrictions? Somewhere the system is broken and failed. Reform is needed. Thank you, Tammy. And Larry?
Well, I love Tammy's comment because she's absolutely right. We've got so many offenses where we just categorically around the country, legislatures have said that this is a violent offense and there's no violence. Electronic solicitation of a minor is deemed a violent offense in many states. And I'm at a loss. Now, I've never professed I'm the smartest person alive, but I can't understand how you could inflict violence online at you at local McDonald's.
Right.
But that's a violent offense in several states. So how it happened, I can answer that quite easily. It happened because they were looking for some way to classify the offenses in terms of how they would register them and what the requirements they would impose on them. And the law enforcement apparatus and the victims advocates were there, and the registrant lobby was absent, and they made a list, and the bill was presented, and they looked at it, and it went through, and people said, looks pretty good to me, because they didn't hear any backlash from anybody saying, wait a minute, here, there's no violence in these offenses. So that's how it happened, because we weren't there. So simple answer, it happened because there was no one there telling them there was anything wrong with it. Hundreds and hundreds of bills move through legislative bodies in very short order. Most states are in session only part-time, 30, 60, 90 days, and they're looking at hundreds of bills. And if there's nobody expressing any concern, they're likely to get a rubber stamp. And that's how it happened. And she's right. The system's broken, needs to be fixed. Reform is needed. That's what we're here for. We need more people like Tammy that recognize this to also get involved and support financially or through efforts of legislative advocacy.
Thank you for that, Tammy. And thank you, Larry. All right. So do we want to do the Timothy comment?
So we could take a stab at it, I suppose. Well, I can just summarize. He says the problem that we're missing on our podcast is that it's the database, and I don't know what the database is. I agree that databases are problematic, and there's databases that shouldn't exist, in my view, that do exist, and I wish they didn't exist. And this one that we're talking about, the Sex Offender Registry, is certainly a database, but I don't know what he's talking about, the database.
Unless it's the NCIC that you had brought up earlier, which is perhaps true. But then that's just everybody. That's not just sex offenders.
So, yeah, it would need more clarity. But governmental databases, he may be talking about just the government compiling large amounts of information on people and how it can be misused. But databases are a scary thing, particularly if you find that they're bad information and try to get it corrected.
My understanding is that the NRA has been very, very active and effective at keeping there from being any level of database in tracking down firearms and their owners. Especially that even if there might be some sort of catalog in your local state, they cannot share that data across jurisdictions of any sort. And that's to keep from ever having the Second Amendment, any level of repeal happen, and then they're able to go track down the owners of said guns. Which is what we have here for the registrants.
I tend to agree with what the NRA is very effective at almost everything they do. And despite how many tragedies we have, I'll bring up the If It Saves One analogy that I'm trying to get people to buy into. I've got one of our associates collecting information about where children have been killed, accidental discharge. There was one just last week in Los Angeles schools where there was like four or five different children hit by one projectile out of a gun that was in a backpack. And then there was a student in Houston that was shot by a accidental discharge of a firearm. So they say if the registry is all worth it, if it saves one, and I'm ready to buy into that. But I want you to buy into this on the other side. If saving one child is worth it, any cost, even if we have to trample the Constitution, if you'll buy into sensible firearms restrictions, I bet if those firearms weren't available to those children, that they wouldn't be dead. And these are just deaths in the last 2 weeks. There are hundreds of shootings and many fatalities across the country with accidental discharges involving children. So if it's about saving one child, if the constitutional encroachments that we do on offenders and their former offenders and their families is worth it to save one child, I would think the same analogy would apply on firearms. If we could just save one child, it would be worth it. Don't you think?
Absolutely. If we're going to save one, we got to save one everywhere.
I would think so.
So thank you for the comments, and I greatly appreciate them. So how can people get in touch with us, Larry?
Well, you people that are listening and want to comment and tell us we're wrong, you can contact us a number of ways. If you can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com or our website, registrymatters.co, or use the inefficient method of a telephone message. And believe me, we are going to get back to people who called. Guy in North Georgia, you've caught me at a bad time when I'm slammed with legislative stuff. But if you call us at 747-227-4477, if you leave a message that's understandable and sounds reasonably coherent, we will get back with you as soon as we can.
Thank you. All right. So for the topic tonight, we are discussing if there is some level of irreparable harm that can be done by doing something versus nothing. An example of this is filing a challenge prematurely. Perhaps there is insufficient evidence to support the challenge, or while other challenges that would support your challenge are going through, maybe in another state or another jurisdiction or something. So what do you think, Larry?
This is a tough one because we grow up believing and having instilled in us that it's better to try and fail than to not try. You're told that about playing ball. I was not a very good athlete, and I was told that if I didn't try, that I was a quitter, and I didn't try very much because I didn't see very well, and I didn't even know until I was 8 years old that I didn't see very well because I was legally blind in one eye and had very, very, very nearsighted in the other. So depth perception was a problem, and I was told if I didn't try that I was a loser. So I don't think I was the only child that was told that. So we grow up believing that it's better to try and fail than to do nothing. Otherwise, you're a quitter. But that's not necessarily the in real life, that's not necessarily true. So we'll have people who will get angry because certain challenges are not being made, and they don't understand that it's premature because the issue isn't ripe. There's not enough case law developed. There's a number of reasons for not initiating a challenge. And you can end up with, by doing a challenge prematurely, you can end up with case law that's bad that will close the door for years, possibly decades, to what would have been a successful challenge later. So in the business that we're in terms of litigation or even legislation sometimes gets hijacked. So if you, when I say hijacked, it's something that starts out with good intentions, is a moving vehicle. So if you start out with a piece of legislation that's well-intentioned, and somebody who has something that's not so well-intentioned that's had trouble moving it, they may use your vehicle that's moving to put something on that legislation that's not so favorable. And if you don't understand how the process works, and if you don't have a disengagement plan, and if you can't disengage quickly enough, you may end up with a good piece of good legislation that's hijacked and ends up not so good, and the outcome is not something you would have wanted. So it's a real struggle for people to accept that sometimes you can do harm by trying, because it goes against what we've been taught about. We need to do something. And I struggle with that all the time, because I tell people, no, we really need to hold our horses here. We're not quite ready to do this. And, well, you're just a quitter. You're just somebody who doesn't understand. If you only understood what people were going through, you wouldn't be so willing to just let this thing linger, because we need to do it, and we need to do it now.
All right. So let's try and come up with an analogy or two. So you ask if I want to come over and play baseball, and I show up with a helmet, shoulder pads, and a brown ball that's sort of oblonged with laces on it. I'm coming over to your field that you're trying to play baseball on, and I'm trying to play football. Is that going to work?
It probably wouldn't work in the game of baseball as I understand it. No.
And as I understand from the conversation we had earlier in the week about this, that there are processes that have to occur through the legislative process where a bill ends up in a committee, and a committee is a small group of people that are going to work through the issues of the bill in a small group of people, so that, and in that committee, you will only have a handful of people. So maybe you're trying to get some sort of registrant-related bill to go through, but the person you're contacting isn't on the criminal justice committee. And you go pound them with hundreds and hundreds of emails from all your constituents saying, hey, don't support this bill, but that person's not even on the committee to have anything to do with it. Is that, am I in the ballpark?
Sort of. That's not necessarily terrible harm. It's a misuse and a misapplication of your resources, and we would try to encourage you to redirect your fire, because a bill in most legislatures doesn't just go straight to the floor for an up or down vote. It'll be assigned to a committee or a number of committees. And presumably, these committees will be able to devote more time to it. If you have 112 lawmakers serving your assembly, and you have 600 bills and memorials in a 30-day session, you can quickly do the arithmetic and figure out on 5 working days a week, and sometimes six, if you had all 112 people looking at those 600 proposals, you can kind of see about how far they would get. So, in a matter of, and you couldn't address very many bills. So most of the work in vetting legislation is done in committees. So they'll assign it to a committee that's most related and has the expertise to the type of legislation. So you wouldn't sign something to agriculture that didn't have anything to do whatsoever with farming, typically. And you wouldn't sign something to judiciary that only had to do with farming, unless there was a legal component to the legislation. So these committees are made up of a group of legislators. So in a 112 member assembly, most committees are five, seven, no more than 15 members, and they're looking and scrutinizing these bills. Well, if you have a bill that's in committee and hasn't made it out to the main floor, be it either the Senate or the House, wherever the bill's being considered, to bombard your member, if he or she is not on that committee, is really not productive, because your member can't help you until it gets to the floor. That's the only time they can give a vote up or down. So your energy, although well-intentioned, I'm going to call the person that represents me, would be better spent on working with the committee. And you're in a catch-22 in some instances, because it may be that nobody that you have in your group that's opposed to that lives in a district that committee is on. In that case, you have to approach the committee chair and say you're speaking on behalf of yourself or a group of people, and you have to try to be heard to affect the process. But you're not going to do long-term damage by sending in emails. All you're going to do is alienate your supporter. And I would say that in my capacity here working for a legislator, when we get bombarded with stuff when it's not even out of committee, it distracts us from the work we're trying to do. We're trying to respond to people who send emails about relevant stuff before the committee, and they say, well, vote on this bill. Well, I can't vote for it. It's not out of committee yet. It's not, I can't vote for it. So 165 emails come in saying vote for a bill that's not out of committee. It's very distracting, and it's irritating if you're inclined to vote for it, but it's not at a point where you can give it your support. And that's what people don't understand. So you're not really doing long-term damage, but you're using your time unwisely with that scattergun approach.
And what I want to bring up about that further is just the idea of getting an education on how this whole thing works, because it's really complicated and it follows a process. That process might not be the most logical of things, and but you have to play the game by their rules, and everybody's rules are different. Every state has a different process of getting something through. I think I can't remember which state it is, but they don't have two sides. They only have one house. Nebraska or something like that.
That would be Nebraska. That's the unicameral.
So those rules are going to be different than one that
So
has.
yes, and
Go ahead.
Indeed, there are vast differences in terms of over date. So, like for example, if you've got a 60-day session and a bill's been introduced in the House of Representatives of that state, if it hasn't completed its journey through all the committees in the House and been approved by the House and crossed over into the Senate, it dies because it hasn't reached crossover. We don't have that here, but some states do. You need to understand that. That's a viable part of your strategy. If it's a bad bill and you see it in the House, and if you can wreck that train long enough to keep it from crossing over, you've won the game because it's for all practical purposes dead. But you need to understand that, or you can't play the game.
And where might there be resources, just off the top of your head, for someone to get the scratch of the surface going through the process of understanding how this all works?
I think most states, now that they have, well, legislative websites, there'll be a tab that they can find about how a bill becomes law, and that would be a big beginning to surf your state's legislature and look for how a bill becomes law, something to that effect. And there'll be a description of if they have those rules about crossover, and there's how many committees, the process of the committee process, how it's going to work.
Now, when I read anything legal, my eyes just roll in the back of my head. I can read computer stuff all day long, all the time. It's awesome. It's my favorite thing. But if I read anything that starts talking about the plaintiff notified here within as the, I can't deal with it. Are these written for the layperson or are they written for the legal scholar?
The how a bill becomes law, generally from the couple websites I've seen, are pretty basic to understand. I'm assuming that most people that would want to get involved in the legislative process are able to read and have a basic comprehension level. But if you can read and understand the language, the understanding how a bill becomes law is not that complicated. And then every public library, if anybody goes to a public library anymore, would have some resources about how the Georgia Assembly works, or whatever assembly you're in. There would be resources in the public library, a
Is
reference librarian could help you.
the bottom line here that if you were going to go work at Boeing and build a 747, that you would want to have an instruction manual of how to build the airplane?
I would say that that's a good analogy, that people who want to be effective, you have a right to go there, and we encourage people, if you do nothing and know nothing, at key points, we encourage people to call and send emails and to sometimes show up. But your effectiveness goes up exponentially if you actually understand what you're doing and where you are in the process and what kind of type of impact you are likely to have.
This is also where lobbyists kick in, isn't it?
It is indeed. The lobbyists understand these processes, and they can help navigate them for the novice. Most of the state groups don't have the money to do that. We've had a couple of states at NARSL who have actually put significant resources into a lobbyist. I think I shouted out Missouri in one of our episodes. They actually passed a bill with the help of a lobbyist that would have made the registry conditions a lot better in Missouri. Ultimately, the governor vetoed the bill because the state patrol objected to it. But they actually they succeeded. They got a bill. They drafted a bill. And they navigate it through the entire process.
But a lobbyist has like the schedule of the events of where the politician is going to be, has the resources to get invited to those events, knows the process, and has the contacts ultimately to try and help you navigate the system and navigate it for you. It's a surrogate on your behalf.
Absolutely. They know things that a novice is going to take years to learn. These processes, you have, even at a part-time legislature, you have bill analysts. The majority has analysts. The minority has analysts. The committees have analysts. And analysts are overworked. There's not enough of them when things are flying in a session. So they're looking for good information. But you have to know who those analysts are. That analyst has to trust you, that they want to rely on the information you provide them. Well, the average novice doesn't even know anything about an analyst and how to find them. But the more you're familiar with the system, the lobbyist certainly knows who the analysts are. And they know how to get information to the analysts to get it in the reports that the committees are going to be looking at. And the majority and minority analysts may come at it from a different perspective. But there's a lot of context that your lobbyist, your experienced lobbyist, is going to have, that it's going to take you a long time to develop, because they know the lobbyist. They don't know you. they don't know how reliable you are in terms of information. They know how reliable the lobbyists. Some lobbyists are just like everybody else. They're unscrupulous ones, and they'll do anything to win on behalf of their clients. There are some lobbyists that'll tell the truth, cut it right down the middle, and tell them what's good and what's bad about a piece of legislation. You want to be in the category of a lobbyist where you're believable, that they can count on you when you tell them this is the reality of the situation, that's not BS and smokescreen. You'll have a lot more success if the analyst and the lawmakers trust you. If you're an unpaid lobbyist, if you are somebody who they can count on for reliable information, you'll find a lot of doors open to you because they need information.
But as you've said earlier, this is a very difficult process to do from 100, 200, 300 miles away from your state capital.
It is indeed, and that's where groups like us struggle because we don't have the ability. The situation in Iowa will probably go unresponded to because we don't have ground forces in Iowa that we can turn to. Mm. And we would devour a significant amount of our resources trying to get ourselves up to speed. I mean, I know for the questions I would need to ask, but I would need to be able to be present. I would need to be able to spend time learning who key people are, and I would need to make calls on key people and give them information about the detriment and what's the likely outcome of this legislation. And I'd have to get to know who's pushing this legislation and how much power they have so that I could try to figure out if there are people that are rational on the other side that are pushing this, if you could work with them or not, or if you just have to try to discredit them. There's a whole lot of considerations, and we're stuck because we don't have those resources to tackle this problem. But the scary thing for us is if we do nothing and Iowa manages to create a registry for people after they've served their time, other states will emulate that because they'll say, well, if they're getting away with it there, why can't we do it here? Why should anybody ever get off of the list?
Right.
So it would be something that would spread to other states. So the national interest is making sure that doesn't spread.
To set precedent for the next state.
So since we've got 20,000 listeners out there, if each one of us will send us a buck.
We can move mountains. Hey, patreon.com/registrymatters. Send the money.
Well, actually, I was half joking about that, but the movement is going to require a commitment from the offenders and their families. The 700,000 to 800,000, whatever the number that is tossed around, those people are going to have to make a little bit of a sacrifice to make this work because there's not another natural group that's going to fight this battle on behalf of registered citizens. There's just no such group that's going to do this. They're going to cherry pick it, and they're going to come in where they think there's money to be made on cases that can be won, like on First Amendment stuff. There'll be organizational support, but there's going to be very little organizational support where there's not legal fees to be won. And that's why we don't have the support, because it's just not viable for an organization to put their resources into fighting for such a despised group of people.
And I don't want to blow my own horn for the sake of that. That's what this podcast represents, is my ability. This is me meeting the situation where I'm most comfortable. And that's from a technology standpoint, that I can run a server. I can get the podcast posted. I have access to you. And I think that I can ask you halfway decent questions and throw together the program to get you online and go over it to try and reach out to the thousands of people listening. That is my method of contributing to this cause, to try and extend our reach to the next batch of people. Maybe the next person does have the ability to have relationships with the people in the Capitol, or maybe somebody else can just donate gobs of money to help us hire a lobbyist. It's going to take all of us to meet at the level that we are comfortable with, and possibly from levels that aren't comfortable with us, like Mary Sue Molnar in Texas, where she's like, I don't know anything about this, but I'm going to try.
And she's an amazing example of, she spent several years, and she's a very effective advocate, very well respected in the Texas Capitol. She doesn't get everything she wants, but she does get things done.
Yep.
I mean, they moved a bill that was very favorable. Unfortunately, got hijacked and ended the process, and that was something that was difficult to explain to people who are not familiar with the bill's hijacking. But they moved a bill that was going to help clarify how to measure distances for offenders to could travel. The probation parole were telling people they had to travel around, and they couldn't drive down certain streets because they would pass exclusion zones. And it was a bill addressing that, so that to stop the overreach of probation and parole. And then they turn around, and then the process, And there was an amendment placed on their bill, and the bad amendment went with the good bill, and it's maybe more harm done by the hijacking. But that's one of those things where it happens. You've got to be ready for that. You've got to understand how a bill's hijacked, how to pull the bill, how to get that commitment from the sponsor that we're not going to move this bill, and make sure that you got a sponsor that has a good relationship with leadership, because the leadership may want the bill to keep moving. So there's so many considerations that you have to understand so that you can wreck their train when your bills are hijacked or when there's an attempt to hijack your legislation.
I want to give a shout out if we're done.
Well, I would love to give a shout out. So let's do it.
All right. The shout out that I have is for a new podcast called Decarceration Nation with Josh and Joel. And it's talking about the whole criminal justice system, not just from a registrant standpoint. And they're on episode 4, and they're doing a really good job. I like what I've heard so far. The latest episode was just released, and it's about cash bail, which I think we're going to cover at some point, is the bond system and the bail system. And so that was my shout out for the week.
So how do I find that podcast for a challenged person like me that just now is learning about podcasts?
The best answer I have for you is, I know that he's trying to get everyone to go through iTunes. If you Google Decarceration Nation, and the first link, and then if you put podcast at the end of it, that's what I just searched for, you should get an iTunes link, and you can listen to it straight there online. And I don't want to go through a whole thing on how to download them onto your phone so you can listen to them in the car and whatnot. That would be something for another day.
So, well, all right. I will look for it.
Excellent. And that's all I have.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
I can't thank you enough, Larry. I appreciate it very much, and I will talk to you very soon.
Thanks.
Bye. Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 10. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.